without the assistance of other lawyers, which are normally referred to as second chairs. I favor this single prosecutor approach, although it may mean more work. Because of this, it falls on my shoulders to read every document associated with the case from any source, such as those provided by defense counsel. I sit through every interview of any potential witness, whether or not I believe they are going to be called to testify at trial. I also view every video created at any point of the investigation, including statements made by a defendant to the police. Preparing the case for trial without the assistance of another prosecutor requires that I make decisions regarding which witnesses to call at trial and the order of their appearance. I am solely responsible for the documents, photographs, or other items to be introduced for the jury's consideration. Of course, any cross-examination of witnesses called to testify by defense counsel will likewise be left to me. Opening statements and closing arguments are strictly my province. This approach requires me to be versed in every aspect of the case. In addition to reading the police reports Flores provided me, I began by creating a more detailed portrait of the victim. I learned that Travis was born on July 29, 1977. According to his Arizona driver's license, he was 5 feet 9 inches tall, weighed 180 pounds, and had green eyes. He was one of 8 children, 4 boys and 4 girls. He grew up near Riverside, California, in an area commonly referred to as the Inland Empire. According to a book he was writing about his life called Raising Me, which was posted on the internet, Travis's parents were methamphetamine addicts, and at a young age he went to live with his grandmother, Norma Sarvey, who introduced him to the Mormon faith. He embraced its teachings and attempted to live by church doctrine. After high school, he went on a church mission to Denver, Colorado, and ultimately settled in Mesa, Arizona, because of its strong Mormon community. I looked into Travis's employment at Prepaid Legal Services, which today is called Legal Shield. Travis worked from home, but he was also a motivational speaker for the company and appeared periodically at meetings to help encourage sales of new memberships. Although Travis portrayed himself as financially successful, it seemed that he was struggling to maintain the lifestyle he had built for himself. He had taken in 2 roommates to help with his mortgage and sometimes borrowed money from an ex-girlfriend to pay his bills. One of the first things I did was check whether Travis Alexander had ever been in trouble with the law, and I found that he hadn't. The only contact he had ever had with police was when he called the Mesa Police Department in February 2008 to report that the tires on his BMW had been slashed while his car was parked outside his house. Although there was only that one call, I learned from Detective Flores's police report that his tires had been slashed on consecutive nights. While all of Travis's friends pointed the finger at Arias, Travis himself vacillated between blaming her and saying he didn't know who had done it. From all that I had read in the police reports, it seemed that Jody Arias had been obsessed with Travis. But, as her interviews with Flores made clear, the irrational nature of her behavior was not reflective of her ability to maintain her composure in the most dire of times. Because Flores had told me that Arias had been so in control during the 2 days of interrogation in Yreka, I needed to look for myself at those interviews to see if she'd made any missteps, however slight. Detective Flores provided me with copies of the videotaped interviews conducted with Arias on July 15th and 16th after her arrest in Yreka. I had a transcript of the tapes prepared, which I checked for accuracy by reading while listening to the actual words being spoken, because it had been my experience that transcriptions always contain mistakes by the transcriber. Even though the transcript is not admissible at trial, I still wanted to make sure it was as accurate as possible so that I could use it in my trial preparation. Closing the door to my office, I turned on the videotape of the July 15th interview on my computer. The first image on the video showed Arias shortly after her arrest, still dressed in white pants and a gray top, resting her head on a small table at the center of the room, her long brown hair falling forward onto the tabletop. She remained in that repose for several minutes, never flinching, to the point where it appeared she was asleep. She then stood up and shook out her arms, and seemingly angry that police had left her in handcuffs, plopped down on the floor with her back to the wall. "Can you take my handcuffs off, please?" were the first words she spoke when Siskiyou Sheriff's Detective Rachel Blaney pushed open the door to check on her. I found it telling that she was so focused on her own comfort when faced with a much bigger issue, that she was in police custody and accused of first-degree murder. Arias appeared irritated when Blaney advised that she'd have to wait for Detective Flores to remove the handcuffs. She lodged her next complaint as soon as Blaney left the room. "It's so fucking cold in here," she mumbled, her shoulders shuddering. The arrival of Flores appeared to mollify Arias, who immediately rose to offer her handcuffed wrists so he could remove the cuffs. Flores's offer of a bottle of water was met with several requests. "Any chance you could get my purse? Any way they can turn the heat up in here? Or, like, do you have a sweater I can borrow or something?" In his relaxed and casual manner, Flores, dressed in a blue button-down shirt and tie, agreed to look into adjusting the temperature and the whereabouts of her purse, which had been taken during her arrest. "So you remember me?" Flores asked once she had finished her litany of requests.
"Of course I do," Arias acknowledged.
"I traveled all the way up here to come talk to you because, you know, I've been working on Travis's case ever since it happened. And I know exactly when it happened, when he was killed. I know a lot of details, and just recently we found quite a bit of evidence, and I'll discuss that with you. The main thing that I'm looking for, though, is answers on why certain things happened and why they went so far, and also to get your statements. A lot of details on this case that haven't been released to the public, and not even to Travis's family. And those details are known only by us and the person who did it, okay? And that's one of the reasons I'm here, is because I believe that you know some of those details. And I think you can help us."
"I would love to help you in any way that I can," Arias responded, leaning in toward the detective, her pale, thin arms crossed at the elbows, stretched on the table. She appeared to be listening as Flores read her the Miranda rights and set out the purpose of the interview.
"What I'm going to do is just ask some questions, ask you what you've been doing, kind of clarify some things."
As I watched this interview, what struck me most was Arias's ability to be so controlled and devoid of emotion right from the start. Most people get extremely apprehensive just being stopped by police for a traffic infraction. Yet Arias demonstrated no reaction as her Miranda rights were read and she was advised, amongst other things, that she had the right to remain silent. But as I was going to see, remaining silent was not something she would ever do.
"Is this recorded at all?" she asked, looking behind her. "Or should we, I mean?"
Before the detective could respond, she reached behind her to retrieve two tape recorders from a small wooden table in the corner of the room, placing them on the table in front of Flores.
"I don't know if these are voice recorders. I noticed them. If they have video cam, or they have audio, or batteries, or what?"
Arias was so aware of her surroundings that she noticed two small recorders lying on the table in the corner behind her. I took note of her acumen and concluded that she would probably never lose her composure, whether it be in an interview room or a courtroom. Flores lifted the recorders and looked at them as if to be checking their status.
"I don't think they are on," he assured her.
To which Arias again complained of being cold and reminded the detective that she had asked that the heat be turned up. Flores sidestepped the temperature issue, bringing the conversation back around to the homicide.
"What have you been up to since Travis's death? What have you been doing?"
Well, I've been working," Arias said. "I haven't been really working for prepaid legal. There's not a whole lot here in this marketplace."
"It's kind of small here."
"It's small here. And really, that could be seen as an opportunity rather than a hindrance, because that just means the market is untapped in a large way, so I could have it if I wanted to. But I'm kind of like a deer in the headlights when it comes to prepaid legal, and I just have a fear of approaching people. So, I've been working in a Mexican restaurant on the north end of town. I've been in kind of a daze, at least for the first few weeks.
Like everybody you know, Flores concurred, obviously trying to keep her talking. Without prompting, Arias turned the conversation to the online tributes and news coverage surrounding Travis's death.
I know that a lot of people have been posting on Facebook really nice things and memories, and at one point I was like, well, maybe I should do that. So I posted this thing, and I just said all of my memories, and I realized, looking back on it, that it kind of sounded immature. It's more like my Dear Travis kind of letter. And so I took it down because...
Arias was referring to her June 14th comment posted on the internet site called Guestbook.
Travis, what can I say to you that I haven't already said? I am so grateful for the endless hours of conversation and amazing experiences we've shared. Thank you for having the courage to share the gospel with me. You've had one of the greatest impacts on my life and have forever altered its course for the better. I love you, my friend, and always will. Jody Arias, Yreka, California.
Responding to Arias's decision to remove the post, Flores suggested that he understood that she likely felt her tribute should probably have been less personal.
Yeah, some of it was details that were a little more personal. Not too personal, nothing inappropriate. I just felt funny. I think because I'm a photographer, I tend to communicate more through pictures, so I posted a ton of pictures that I had of him, and I have a ton more that I just can't access right now, and videos and things that I know his family would want.
Arias answered.
I've been on Facebook and MySpace looking at his profile, looking at his pictures, reading things about his obituaries, and any news updates, and, you know, there's legacy.com, right? You can write something about him.
I've seen a lot of those postings, Flores admitted. Arias indicated that since Travis's death, she had also been spending a good deal of time speaking to Ryan Burns, whom she described as her
potential possible maybe person that you might start dating. She explained that she and Ryan tried not to speak about what happened to Travis, because it's kind of like, oh, and plus, Travis is my ex-boyfriend at the same time he's my friend, so while I'm mourning my friend, how do you talk to your new potential possible maybe person that you might start dating about your friend, even if he was your ex-boyfriend? So it's kind of a gray area. I try not to talk about him too much, but he comes up a lot.
Arias told Flores that it was through Burns that she first learned that she was emerging as a suspect in Travis's killing.
He said, you know, if you come out to Utah, things are really weird, because everyone thinks that you could have had a hand.
Flores took the opportunity to interject, and I've talked to a lot of people, and everybody's pointing the finger at you. You know, everyone is saying, I don't understand what happened to Travis. I don't know who killed him, but you need to look at Jody. And sometimes the simplest answers are the correct ones, and that's one of the reasons I've started looking at you a little bit closer. So one of the reasons I am here is to talk to you to figure out what was going on between you two. I know the relationship that you guys had was of convenience sometimes. Obviously, you weren't boyfriend-girlfriend anymore. But you were still having a sexual relationship, which you know...
Flores's declaration appeared to stir something in Arias. Does his family know about that?
She asked, the first time in the interview she expressed concern over something. She claimed it was because she wanted to protect Travis and how he was remembered. Even after Flores assured her that Travis's family didn't know anything, Arias continued to steer the interview in this direction. She seemed overly concerned with the afternoon sexual encounter and appeared to be prying into the images that were actually recovered. Her preoccupation led me to think that perhaps there were more than 6 photographs taken that afternoon during their sexual romp.
The reason I care about that is because he was adamant about that, and a couple times we prayed about it. It didn't work, or we didn't stick to our, you know, guns on it, and, one time a girlfriend of mine just said, "Why don't you just go to the bishop and talk and ask Travis the same?" And I talked to him about it, and he got really angry. He said, "I've already had problems with this in the past. I'm embarrassed by it. I don't want to go to the bishop." And so we just kind of stopped for like a few weeks, and then that must have been in, I think it was August, and then it just resumed. As I watched the video over the course of several hours, I came across numerous things that would be helpful in my preparation of the case, ranging from small, incongruous details in her story to Arius's ability to maintain composure. More than anything, though, I was able to discern how she attempted to manipulate the situation to her advantage and buy herself time to respond to Flores's questions. Detective Flores wanted Arius to know that as part of the police investigation, he'd read Travis's journals. And he told her that they indicated that Travis felt his relationship with Arius was unhealthy. "Maybe you didn't understand why he didn't believe it was healthy?" "No, I didn't think it was healthy either. Spiritually, at least, and probably emotionally, but mostly spiritually. And once you have something that's not healthy spiritually, it filters through all aspects of your life." Arius continued, saying that while that was one of the reasons she moved back to Yreka, it was not the primary reason. Instead, she cited financial hardship, followed by desire to be closer to her family, particularly her younger siblings, as her number one and two reasons. But also, as she put it, "Too much of my nightlife was about Travis." She went on to describe Travis's supposed late-night requests to see her, saying that he would text me and, "Hey, I'm getting sleepy, dot, 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 and a bunch of Z's," and that was code to, like, "come on over" kind of thing. As I listened to her describe the relationship, it was easy to see the routine that their relationship had apparently taken. As Arius described it, "I lived 5 minutes away to maybe 10, depending, and it was just too convenient and too easy, and it was fun, and we had fun when we were together, and so it wasn't healthy, and I totally agree with that." At different points during the interview, Arius talked about how she and Travis struggled with the sexual dynamic of their relationship. When she was trying to find work, Travis offered her a job cleaning his house to help her pay her bills, and she grew animated as she described a photo of a French maid's outfit that he purportedly emailed to her, instructing her to wear this kind of ensemble on her first day of work. For a tumultuous period of time, the two of them had carried on a secret sexual relationship, characterized by fits of jealousy and deceit. According to her, Travis's friends warned Arius that he was actively dating and looking elsewhere for a mate, and she recalled how one in particular had even confronted Travis about his behavior, asking, "Why do you kiss Jody in the dark and then act like you guys aren't even together in the daytime?" Throughout the two-day interviews, it seemed clear to me that Arius was playing the part of the victim, whether it was crying about her father's failing health, expressing her love for her family, or complaining of Travis's infidelity. But that was not a role that was written for her, at least not under these circumstances. It appeared she thought her sob story would go a long way in making things easier for her, but given the accusations being leveled, it showed remarkable self-centeredness. She seemed to exude a confidence that she could control the interview, and by extension, Detective Flores, if she came across as sympathetic. Flores remained undeterred, digging into each facet of Arius's relationship with Travis as he tried to have his questions answered. I found it interesting that she was evasive with Detective Flores as to why she moved to Mesa after the breakup. Rather than address her stalking behavior, she chose to ramble about different living arrangements she had worked out that would allow her to be in Mesa, but within a safe and appropriate distance of Travis and his church ward. She even claimed that it had been Travis who had talked her into moving back to Arizona, suggesting that when she entertained the idea of moving to Southern California, He had offered up a litany of reasons why Mesa would be the more desirable location.
"And he's really persuasive," she said, smiling.
"He persuaded you to stay there in Mesa?" Flores asked, a tone of disbelief in his voice.
He kind of was playing up all the advantages if I did come to Mesa. You know, it's a great place. We could still see each other and hang out on occasion. This church is very strong. You know, you'll probably make a lot of friends. And I already knew all this stuff prior because we'd talked about that. So I went ahead and just made the move. It sounded at the time like a good idea.
No more than 5 minutes later, Arias contradicted herself when she told Flores that when one of her roommate situations in Mesa didn't work out and she moved again to a place that was closer to Travis's, he freaked out about it.
This was the kind of discrepancy that revealed how she could meld a story to her benefit.
Other inconsistencies in Arias's story were revealed when Flores began to question the route that she claimed to have taken to Utah on June 3rd.
He began his questions by talking about the car she rented for the trip. At first, Arias tried to stymie the investigation altogether by failing to name the rental car company that she used to reserve a car for the drive, as if withholding it would make it impossible for the police to track her movements. Despite not remembering the rental car company itself, she did recall every other detail about the car she rented, including that she had rented it at the Redding Airport, that it was a white Ford Focus, and that it didn't have cruise control.
"Instead of going to Utah, you went straight out to the Los Angeles area?" Flores asked.
Arias's voice was soft and steady as she recounted her movements for the detective.
"I went to Santa Cruz first. I stayed the night in Monterey, and the next day I drove to Pasadena."
She explained that she had arranged to meet the sister of an ex-boyfriend to do a photo shoot of her new baby.
She said when she first arrived in town, she left a voice message on the woman's answering machine, but she didn't get a call back until she'd already left the Los Angeles area.
"And which route did you take from there?" Flores asked.
He already knew the route she claimed to have taken from their previous conversations, but now he was prepared to dispute her story.
The detective listened intently as Arias recited her itinerary.
"I was supposed to get on the 15 and go all the way up, and I somehow got off the 15, she explained.
"And where did you end up?"
For a while I was lost, and I'm not above sleeping in the car, so I slept for a while. I'm a heavy sleeper and I sleep a lot, so..."
"But you were on the 15 for a while, and you ended up getting off the 15 somewhere?"
"Yeah. I looked at a map, and I'm pretty sure I know where I went. Can I draw you a map?"
Detective Flores offered Arias the yellow legal pad he had been using to take notes, and she sketched the circuitous route that took her to Las Vegas and then south into Arizona. She said she first took Interstate 15 north toward Las Vegas on the way to Utah. She then began talking about another freeway, Interstate 40, which runs east and west through northern Arizona.
"Did you actually cross over into Arizona? Is that how far you went?"
"I crossed over twice, I think," Arias said with a giggle.
She next provided an elaborate account of traveling on various freeways, starting with Interstate 15, which runs north from the Pasadena area to Salt Lake City. She claimed that once she arrived in Las Vegas, she mistakenly began driving south on Highway 93 past the Hoover Dam and into Arizona. She said she became disoriented and further lost her way when she ended up on Interstate 40, driving east towards Flagstaff. She said she finally turned around on that interstate and made her way back to Highway 93, heading north back toward Las Vegas, where she finally was able to be reunited with Interstate 15, allowing her to head north toward Salt Lake City.
"I have a problem with this trip," Flores declared. "I've gone over this trip over and over in my mind and on paper, and even if there's still 20-some-odd hours, even if you pulled over to sleep a couple of times."
The detective's inquiry appeared to be a warning that Arias's alibi was not airtight, but she remained impassive and revealed no sign of anxiety.
"Did I tell you I got stranded?" she asked, hearkening back to her earlier claim.
"Yeah, you mentioned that. But if you slept for 10 hours here and here, it would still leave 18-some-odd hours for something else, okay?"
Flores then shifted his line of questioning to a discussion of Arius's cell phone.
"I pulled your cell phone records," he said, referring to a cell phone tower report that police had obtained. "Your cell phone was turned off between here and here," he told her, indicating a stretch of land east of Pasadena, California, to a location south of the Nevada border. "The next place it was turned on was here," he said, pointing to a site on Highway 93. "What does that show me?"
A cell phone cannot be traced if it is powered off. While this piece of evidence alone did not prove anything about where Arius had driven, it would become important to the case because it helped show premeditation. Turning off the cell phone was a deliberate way for Arius to avoid being tracked. It seemed too much of a coincidence that her phone lost power as she approached the western part of the Arizona border, only to have it powered on as she reached Nevada. Still, Arius didn't budge.
"Oh, well, I began... Oh, no, no, no."
"Is there plenty of time for you to do that? Yes. And do I believe that you had come to visit Travis? Yes, I truly believe it. Did you have the opportunity? Yes, you were traveling alone. There are no other witnesses. Your phone just happened to turn off from here to here?"
"Well, I didn't turn it off physically, but it died."
"And then it magically, you found your charger here?"
"I got it. It was under the back under the seat on the passenger side, and it was when I was..."
"When you were lost, you couldn't have maybe pulled over and found it, or..."
"Well, I did finally start looking when I was stranded. I wouldn't have pulled over when I was lost," she answered, parsing out that she would only stop if she were stranded.
"I've been focusing on this and going over and over in my mind why this happened, why your phone turns off here, outside of Los Angeles,"
the detective posed, indicating a location on Arius's makeshift map.
"What city is that? 'Cause I got this far," she responded, pointing to a similar area on the map.
"It's not cities, there's towers,"
Flores explained, referring to the cell towers that had pinged with Arius's locations.
Flores was trying to show her that based on the data from the cell phone tower, she had eventually turned her phone on as she approached the Nevada border, but while she was still in Arizona. "There's towers dotted all over this place. One tower hit here," he said, highlighting various spots on the map. "The other tower here on the 93. There is no way somebody can get on that 15 and magically get on that 93, because the 15 goes right through Las Vegas, right there, and continues this way. It never goes through Arizona again. This tower here, it's not just over the border in Arizona, it's quite a distance inside of Arizona that it hit, because there is a mountain range all along here, and if you are on this side of the mountain range, a pretty good distance, that signal is not going to come, not going to hit Utah or Nevada or California. It's only going to hit in Arizona." After going back and forth on her impossible route, Arius again went to the map, but when Detective Flores confronted her about the freeways and the impossibility of her trip, she started to lose composure and for the first time admitted that she took Interstate 10. In her haste to cover up, she mistakenly said she traveled west on Interstate 10, which, if true, would have taken her to the beach in Santa Monica.
"I honestly got lost. It's bad timing," Arius said, hiding her face in her hands.
"Were you at Travis's house on Wednesday?"
"Absolutely not. I was nowhere near Mesa. I was nowhere near Phoenix."
Detective Flores let out an audible sigh in apparent frustration. Her unwillingness to surrender even in the face of compelling proof showed just how much it would take to get her to concede a point. I would need tangible evidence contradicting her story. But I was about to see that even that would not shake Arius.
"What if I could show you proof you were there? Would that change your mind?"
"I wasn't there. I was not at Travis's house. Was not."
You were at Travis's house. You guys had a sexual encounter, which there are pictures. And I know you know there's pictures because I have them. And I will show them to you, okay? So what I'm asking you is for you to be honest with me. I know you were there.
Are you sure those pictures aren't from another time?
Positive. Absolutely positive.
Arius's body language did not change. She sat hunched over the table, her arms folded in front of her, and in a soft voice recited her mantra.
The last time I had any kind of sexual contact with Travis was in April.
Detective Flores reminded her of the camera police had found in the washing machine during the initial investigation at the crime scene, the one she had offered to help police retrieve items from the memory card.
Remember I told you about the camera?
Mm-hmm.
Remember I told you that card was destroyed?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tell the truth, because I wanted to make sure those photos were accurate. And we can pull deleted photos. We can pull every photo that was ever on there, pull the pixels together, get the timestamps on them. Not all of them, but most of them have timestamps on them, and we can verify those timestamps. And I have pictures of you in Travis's bedroom with Travis, pictures of him, and it's obvious you guys are having sex, taking photos of each other, and they're dated and timestamped on the day he died.
Are you sure it's me? Arius asked incredulously. I mean that, 'cause I was not there.
Flores forged ahead, advising Arius that the camera had actually taken pictures by accident during the time that Travis was killed. For the first time, there was a reaction.
Really?
She asked, the muscles in her forehead tightening, perhaps indicating that the detective had struck a nerve. Watching Arius skillfully manipulate the realities being presented to her, I couldn't help but think ahead to a possible trial. If she were to take the stand, she would be difficult for me to deal with, because her stories streamed forth so effortlessly. If I was going to show she was untruthful, I would have to come up with something factual like a receipt, something that she was not aware of or that she had forgotten about. Otherwise, there was a real chance a jury might be taken in by the seamless delivery of her answers. I turned my attention back to the video just in time to hear Flores make mention of a gun.
A record check shows that you guys reported a gun stolen, a .25 auto, that just happens to be the same caliber as the weapon used to kill him, he told Arius.
A .25 auto was used to kill Travis?
She whispered, acting as if she were surprised at the revelation.
Yeah, along with multiple stab wounds, Flores responded.
But the information about the caliber of the gun used wasn't enough to change her story either, and as Flores prepared to bring in the photos that proved their sexual encounter, she seemed to double down on her innocence.
If I killed Travis, I would beg for the death penalty, she said.
Detective Flores continued to push in what seemed a calculated effort to draw out a confession. But as hard as he pressed, he still couldn't stop the conversation from going in circles, with him laying out the evidence and Arius deflecting the blame.
I was not at Travis's house on Wednesday the 4th, she repeated.
You were, 'cause that is when the bloody palm print was left on his wall, Flores advised her. I've got pictures of you that I've blown up, and you've got that little mole right there, he said, pointing to a small mark on her left lower cheek. It's you. It's obvious.
I wasn't there, Arius maintained.
There's pictures of you laying on the bed in pigtails.
Pigtails?
She asked incredulously, cocking her head to the side as if in disbelief.
I can show you some of these pictures. Do you want to see the pictures? Will that change your mind?
Flores suggested they take a short break so he could retrieve them. Arius called out to him as he rose to leave the room.
Detective, she wailed with a hurt look, I am not a murderer.
Chapter 6. When Detective Flores returned to the interview room, he was carrying the same blue three-ring binder he had brought to my office at the start of the investigation.
What kind of gun is that?
Arius asked him, referring to the weapon in his holster.
It appeared she wanted to show some interest in him and maybe even flirt with him a little.
It's a Glock.
I just got a gun.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
They've probably found it by now, Flores told her, referring to the police officers executing the search warrants on the homes of her grandparents and parents, as well as the rental vehicle in which she had packed 3 boxes and a suitcase. The 9mm gun would later be found stashed in the trunk of the rental car. Arias remained impassive as the detective sat down in the chair across from her, held the binder in his lap so as to shield the pictures from her view, and began to leaf through its pages.
These are just a few photos, and I want to be careful not showing you certain photos, because some of them...
Please don't show me, Arias pleaded with seeming anguish.
After reviewing several of the pages, Flores placed the book on the table, opened to a photograph of the exterior of Travis' house that had been taken by police at the crime scene.
Remember that?
Arias hid her face in her hands and began to sob. If Travis were here today, he would tell you that it wasn't me.
No, my job is to speak for Travis right now, and everything Travis is telling me is that Jody did this to me,
Flores explained in a stern but mild voice. Returning the binder to his lap, he again glanced through its pages, momentarily stopping to consider several photographs before deciding on one. Sliding the book toward Arias, he showed her a close-up shot of Travis's face, his hair wet and water cascading down his face.
Remember him?
Is he naked in the shower?
Yes, he is, Flores replied, soon after you and he had sex on his bed.
Looking directly at the detective, Arias tried to neutralize the evidence now before her. Travis would never go for that, she stated matter-of-factly. The last time we had sex in his bed was in April.
Flores was undeterred. This didn't come out very good because they're copies of actual photos, he explained, purposefully placing his legal pad over the lower portion of the next image, a shot of Arias naked and lying back on Travis's bed in a sexual pose.
That's you, and I wanted to cover you up because that's all of you.
Oh! Arias uttered with an air of surprise. That looks like me, she confirmed, perhaps her way of avoiding having to admit the obvious.
You can look at the rest of it if you want, Flores suggested, prompting her to lift up a corner of the legal pad so she could view the full image.
There's a few of those, the detective told her, and there's a few more which I'm trying not to show you, because I don't want to put you out there like that to people. Let's just say I've seen all of you, and I've seen all of Travis. But the one that sticks out in my mind is of Travis on the autopsy table. And I'm not going to show you that one.
Or should I?
But this one, he said, flipping the page to one of the snapshots that had been taken by accident. It's your foot, Jody.
He used his pen to highlight parts he wanted to call to Arias's attention.
Those are your pants. That's Travis.
This is his bathroom, she agreed, appearing to study the image before again starting to cry. That is not my foot. Flores did not give an inch.
Those are your pants, he told her.
I have those pants at home if these are the same ones. I don't have a zipper there, though, not on mine.
Next came another round of photographs. You see the date? 6/4/08 at 5:22 p.m. That's when it started. Right there, see that?
Arias picked over the little details in the photos that Flores highlighted.
Do you see the spots here? He asked her now, showing her the photograph of the latent print on the west wall. They look a different color because we used a chemical to enhance this. That right there is blood. It's a mixture of yours and his, and that's your palm print of your left palm.
I don't have any cuts on my left palm, Arias offered.
Nobody said that your cut was on the palm. Do you have any recent cuts that are healing?
Well, my cat scratches me. Little things. These are all her work, you can see, she said, pointing out little marks on her left arm before again challenging the evidence. How can that be my palm print?
Because you were there,
Flores replied, moving his chair to sit closer to Arius. There is no doubt in my mind that you were there. There is no doubt in my mind that you did this. None. So you can go until you're blue in the face and tell me you weren't there and you had nothing to do with this, but I won't believe you. I will not believe you because Travis is telling me that you did this to him. The interview seemed to drag on, while Flores finally got her to agree that the photographic evidence was very compelling. She diffused its value, suggesting the images could have been modified or altered, and the date and timestamps could have been tampered with. I didn't modify anything, Flores countered.
I don't think you would, Arius responded, perhaps sensing she might alienate the detective if she continued in this vein.
After watching her repeated denials, I was momentarily caught off guard when suddenly Arius appeared to change course, from accusing the police of manipulating the timestamps on the photos to questioning that it was Travis's camera that may have taken those photographs.
Can I ask you, I don't know if you know this, oh, I have a camera and it's in my storage unit that I don't use anymore, but that Travis used frequently, Arius began. And we took pictures with it. This is, I don't know.
Do you remember taking these pictures? Flores asked, directing Arius's attention back to the collection of photographs in the blue binder on the table between them.
There were many pictures. We took tons and tons of pictures. Some I saved, most we deleted, she claimed.
It was clear Detective Flores didn't know where she was going with the story, but he continued to lead her along in the direction of what he thought would be an admission.
We took a bunch the week before I left. We took a bunch over the last 6 or 7 months. Last year, even, when we were still dating, but we would delete them mostly. There were some he sent me that I didn't delete. What I'm asking is it possible that, you know, that my memory card would have been in his camera? They're interchangeable.
And with that, Jodi Arius had another possible explanation for how those photographs came to be in Travis's camera. When initially confronted by the existence of the images from the camera found in the washing machine, she tried several different possible denials, ranging from the images not being of her, to the police tampering with the timestamps on the images, and now something far more complicated and wholly implausible. She advanced the notion that someone had switched the memory card in the camera found in the washing machine with the camera she had previously used to take photos of herself and Travis. Though she'd been at an apparent dead end, she was unwilling to cede the point. She seemed prepared to keep evading, creating ever more elaborate fictional scenarios, anything to avoid the truth. She had clearly realized the photos' significance and was looking for a way to discount them, thereby removing what she saw as the only indisputable piece of evidence placing her at the crime scene. It appeared she thought she knew enough to explain away the DNA evidence collected at the scene, the blood, the hair, and perhaps even the palm print, but she was at a loss to find a rationalization for the time-stamped photographs. Detective Flores realized what she was trying to do and pointed out that her theory of switched memory cards was completely implausible. Your camera's here, his camera's there. He just bought that camera.
Well, the other camera that I used before that is broken. Now it's in my storage unit.
Are you saying those pictures are on that camera? Flores asked in an attempt to clarify what she was alleging.
What I'm saying is I had several memory cards for this camera that I don't have anymore, so I guess it's so far-fetched, she conceded, but I guess it's possible that my card could...
Flores interjected. So you're saying somebody took your pictures or card and is framing you and put that into his camera?
I'm just saying that if my memory cards were left at his house, he would have used those for his camera. I don't know. I can explain the blood, though, and I can explain the hair. I don't know about the palm print.
There it was. She really did believe that she could smile at the detective and have him believe that such a scenario was possible. Even in light of the scientific results, she held true to her story.
Flores had spent 2 hours and 47 minutes with her and was no closer to a confession than when he started. The interview drew to a close with Arias asking to use the restroom. As soon as the detective left the room, she let out an audible sigh and threw her entire body back in the chair, her arms outstretched to the wall.
"You should have at least done your makeup, Jody. Gosh!" she whispered aloud.
She next sang part of Dido's "Here With Me." She then spent a few seconds searching through the plastic garbage pail on the floor behind her. I was surprised when she suddenly stood up, placed her head on the floor, and did a handstand, her body perfectly aligned with the wall. Returning to the table, she sat quietly for a few moments before breaking into eerie laughter and then a few verses of "O Holy Night." Her search of the small table in the corner yielded a piece of paper and a pen that she used to scrawl as she waited for someone to come for her. After reviewing Jody Arias's interview of July 15th, I turned my attention to the videotaped statements of her parents, William, Bill, and Sandy Arias. Detective Flores interviewed the couple the same day, shortly after having spoken to Arias. I was curious to see if they had provided any information that would either support or undermine their daughter's unwavering claim that she had nothing to do with Travis's death. Detective Flores had already told me that they had no information, but I wanted to hear what they had to say. The couple were celebrating their 29th wedding anniversary in September 2008. Jody was the oldest of their 4 children. Bill also had a daughter from a previous marriage. Their interviews were conducted separately so that they would not have a chance to tailor their stories. Investigators typically don't meet with the parents of suspects because they seldom have much to offer related to the killing. However, in this case, Arias had returned home to Yreka, and both of her parents could speak to her daily activities and movements in the days before and after the killing. Interestingly, Jody's father, Bill Arias, had some concerning things to say about his daughter. He had just celebrated his 59th birthday, but appeared older, likely because of health issues involving his kidneys. Without prompting, he began to paint an unflattering picture of a young woman who didn't really get along with either of her parents. "She's a strange person," he said at one point, "because after she left the house, she just kind of got strange, She's really friendly sometimes. She'll call and be real sweet, and 10 minutes later she'll call in a rage, just screaming at my wife. And she did that for, the last year and a half she was doing that." What began to emerge was that the story of the relationship with Travis she had told to her family was in stark contrast to the way Travis's friends and people who knew the couple had described it. Arias had indicated to her parents that she and Travis had considered getting married. Bill described a phone call he received from his daughter shortly after she had moved to Mesa. "She called me, hysterically crying," he recalled. "She snuck up at his house and she looked in the window and she saw him on the couch with another woman. And she was planning on marrying this guy. So she just left. But then she stayed there, for, I don't know, how many months, 6 months or something, and Jody would not let anybody say anything or discredit him either. 'Cause I did say a few things after she told me that he was with another girl. I said, 'You need to get the hell out of that town and leave that guy alone.' But then every time I called her, she was over his house. Every time I called her." In listening to the conversation, Flores and Bill Arias seemed like they were old friends sharing stories about a distant relative. Arias's father recounted a 3-hour conversation he and his wife had with Jody soon after Travis's death. Bill was on the dialysis machine when Jody had stopped by for a visit. He and Sandy were trying to find out why she believed she needed to leave town. And she goes, "'Cause I might be blamed for something." I go, "What?" And she goes, "I can't tell you." She goes, "I just won't tell you." And she refused, never told us.
Bill went on to say that Jody quit her job at Casa Ramos after learning police had called the restaurant asking to speak with her. I said, "Well, what are you running away for if you're not guilty?" To which she replied, "'Cause I don't want to be a part of it." Flores took the opportunity to relate the challenges he had confronted when trying to speak to Jody.
"Well, I talked to her for over an hour and a half, and I left with some more questions than I had answers for. You know, I still don't know why. She just refused to tell me."
"She don't talk to us either," Bill commiserated with Flores, telling him that Jody treated her mother like crap. I mean, verbally abusive on the phone with her. You know, we could never ask her anything about her personal life ever since the day she left the house. As it turned out, neither Bill nor Sandy had ever even seen a picture of Travis until after he'd died. Jody never showed them a thing. The information Bill shared next was of particular interest. He indicated that Arias had not been honest with her parents since she was 14. "You know, she doesn't trust us because we're parents. And when she was in eighth grade, she got busted for growing marijuana with our Tupperware, putting it on top of the roof. We found it and we called the sheriff's department and they busted her. And then, I don't know, we searched her room. And after that, she was kind of like, something turned in her head that we were nosy parents and we were going to search everything she had. So she hid everything from us. And she has never been honest with us since then." That her father was referencing an event from when Arias was 14 years old with such specificity indicated how significant the event had been to the family. This was important because it confirmed what Flores had just experienced during his interview with her. Arias had a practiced history of hiding and avoiding the truth in dealings with her parents, which she put to use in explaining away the importance of any item showing she had been the one who killed Travis. Bill also told Flores that Jody asked him to pick her up at her grandparents' house at 7:30 a.m. on the morning of July 15th and give her a ride to the rental car place. "And I thought it was going to be for good, you know, and I'm thinking, And then when I was talking to her, she goes, "Oh, don't worry, Dad, I'm only going to be gone for 3 days. According to Arias' father, her plan was to visit with friends in the Monterey area of California. He told Flores that Jody had indicated she was planning to visit a couple of ex-boyfriends, Daryl Brewer and Matthew McCartney. But police were never able to establish her true destination based on what she had packed into the car. Jody's mother, Sandy, was also of the belief that her daughter was only intending to leave Yreka for a short jaunt, something her parents had come to expect from her. "That's Jody," she told Flores during a painful interview. Sandy Arias, a pleasant-looking brunette who had just turned 50 that past March, entered the interview room in tears. She was visibly distraught over her daughter's circumstances and broke out sobbing the moment she sat down at the table with Flores. The biggest hurdle for Sandy was her inability to reconcile Jody's seemingly ordinary behavior with the police's accusations that she had taken a life. She described her daughter's demeanor in the days after her trip to Utah in June as completely normal. Jody's normal behavior was in sharp contrast to what Sandy experienced at other times when she described her daughter as someone with mental problems who would freak out all the time. "I had quite a few of her friends call me and tell me that I needed to get her some help," she said, weeping. "She would call me in the morning all happy and call me an hour or two later in tears, crying and sobbing about something she didn't want to talk about. And it happened constantly." Like her husband, Sandy seemed to harbor her own initial suspicions about Jody's involvement in Travis's death, saying that was the first thing she asked her about when she came home. She went on to describe how, on the day Jody learned of Travis's death, she went not to her mother, but to her younger sister for comfort. "She was totally in tears. She cried for 2 or 3, 4 or 5 days, and, that's the first I asked her. I said, 'Did you go to Arizona?' And she said, 'No, I was nowhere near Arizona, and I have gas receipts and everything to prove it.' So, of course, I believed her.
You know, but I questioned her about it.
The significance of what Sandy was saying, that she, Jody Arias's own mother, had her suspicions about Jody's involvement in the murder, was not lost on Flores.
But you had enough suspicion to ask her.
Well, yeah.
Sandy Arias explained that her daughter guarded her privacy so vehemently that she wouldn't even let her and her husband stay with her when she lived in Palm Desert with a previous boyfriend, Daryl Brewer.
She was afraid I would snoop through her stuff. That's the kind of relationship she had. I told her one day, "You need some help, Jody." I said, "You've got this fantasy in your head that you had a rotten childhood, and that we searched your room all the time and we did all this stuff, and we didn't. And you need some help," I said, "because that didn't happen."
Sandy told Flores about a late-night visit she had with Jody the previous evening. She couldn't sleep and had called her daughter to ask if Jody could borrow her grandfather's car to drive over to the house so they could spend some time together. Instead, Sandy ended up driving to her parents on Pine Street, where they sat outside in the car and talked.
"In the last couple of weeks since Travis's death, we've had the best relationship we've had in our whole life." And I said, "Maybe this death has made her see that life is short. And, you know, you can't be this way. And it's changing her. So the last few weeks, I didn't spend a lot of time with her, but I talked to her more than I have ever talked to her since she left the house at 18.
At certain moments during the interview, Arias's mother appeared willing to entertain the idea that her daughter might have killed Travis.
"I don't know. Maybe she did do it,"
she conceded, wiping tears from her eyes before continuing.
"I just cannot imagine her doing it."
I paused the video on those words and turned them over in my head. It is always difficult to watch parents of the accused struggle with their children's crimes. No matter how strained the relationship, few parents can really believe that their child is capable of taking a life. Sandy Arias was no different. But conflicted as Sandy may have been about Jody's possible involvement in Travis's death, as well as her apparent mental instability, one thing that Sandy was not conflicted about was Jody's intelligence.
"Jody is a very intelligent person," she told Flores confidently.
Her mother's words echoed what I'd already come to observe, that I was dealing with a highly intelligent woman who happened to be a killer. It was apparent that Arias brought a level of careful forethought to each response, even though she had limited time to formulate her answers. "She's extremely intelligent, and the more I've talked to her over the last month and a half, I know she's intelligent," Flores said. The detective's comment elicited a response from Arias's mother that shone a light on an aspect of Arias's personality that I would encounter again, an inflated sense of intelligence, a belief that she was smarter than everyone else.
"She gave us a hard time because I never went to college, and she kept telling me, 'Mom, you need to read. You need to do this. You need to better your life.'"
Arias had made these criticisms, although she herself had not graduated from high school.
"I don't know. I just can't even imagine. My God, I can't. I just can't even think about it,"
Sandy said, trying to absorb the significance of the allegations against her daughter. "Unfortunately, the evidence that we have is completely convincing to me. I mean, we have everything from fingerprints at the scene of the crime."
"Well, I know her fingerprints are there."
"Her DNA, things like her hair."
"Well, you know she spent time with him, you know. So does that prove that she killed him? She cleaned his house."
It was symbolic that Arias's mother was ending her interview in the same place as her daughter, by trying to excuse away the evidence from the scene. Chapter 7. For the July 16th interview, it had been decided that Siskiyou County Sheriff's Detective Rachel Blaney would conduct it, while Detective Flores waited outside the room, monitoring what was being said. Looking back and now knowing Arias, it is obvious that she would never have bonded with a female detective, because she seemed to know that she would have a more difficult time manipulating a woman.
During her nearly two-hour interrogation with Detective Blaney, Arias twice asked to see the crime scene photos that Flores had declined to show her the previous day, and once again her requests were denied. For her part, Blaney made little headway, and it got to the point in the interview where Blaney asked if Arias would prefer to continue with Detective Flores. "If you want to speak to Detective Flores as opposed to me, you can do that. I thought it would be easier for you to talk to a woman who could relate to some of these feelings," Blaney told her.
"I kind of do want to talk to him, because he's always been in contact with Travis's family a lot," Arias replied, without actually knowing what Flores's contact with the family had been.
When Flores arrived a few minutes later, dressed in a brown button-down shirt and a pair of slacks, Arias greeted him with a "Hey!" and a smile.
"Rachel said something about you wanting to see some photos, but I don't think I can show you any more photos," Flores told her, obviously uncomfortable with the idea of tipping his hand any further by allowing her to see the remaining photographs. "He had called me after the first interview and expressed concern that Arias only wanted to see the pictures to learn what police had observed at the scene." Her next statement confirmed his suspicions.
"The reason I asked was because I just feel like it might help me piece some things together. And this is more of a selfish reason. I think it might give me some sense of closure. I know it's kind of morbid. I don't even think I really deserve closure. His family does. But I wasn't able to attend his funeral, and it's just, I don't know, that's just why, mostly."
"What is it you want to know about the photos?" Flores asked her. "Do you want to see the room? Do you want to see the bathroom? Or do you want to see him? Or is it the photos before it happened that you want to see?"
She told him she wanted to see the pictures of everything, but the ones she was really interested in were the ones in the bathroom, the ones of Travis's body in the shower.
"I don't want to show you those. Not in good conscience."
"Okay. Is there any that you can?"
By this point, it was clear that Arias's interest in the photographs was beyond an obsession. When she realized that Flores was not going to let her view the crime scene photos, she turned the conversation back to Travis's family.